Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, starting first with the Lakers. And the reason I do that is it's been more than a week since LeBron announced that he was joining the Lakers. So it seems like now would be a pretty good time to touch base to see how the fans are dealing with that news. And based on the graffiti on a mural, the answer is not that good. Some of the fans, not so good. Because sometime over the weekend, a mural of LeBron James was defaced by some bitter fans. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, right? It makes sense. I mean, the last time he left Cleveland, some clowns were burning jerseys in the street. So it would make sense that this time, those same clowns might start to spray paint over a mural. Oh, wait. Did I mention the mural is not in Cleveland? It's in Los Angeles. The mural is near Venice Beach. So it wasn't bitter Cleveland fans defacing the artwork. It appears to have been the work of bitter Laker fans. You know, wait, what? That's right. Shortly after LeBron announced that he was going to join the Lakers, a mural goes up in Venice with LeBron in a Lakers jersey and the words, "The King of LA." So then some dude on Twitter who claims to be a Laker fan offered $300 for somebody to deface it. And sure enough, that mural then read, "We don't want you, 3-6, no king, and La Fraud." Hell yes. Awesome. Hey, you showed him. Hell yes. You showed him. I mean, you showed what real basketball fans you are, because you don't want the best player in the league on your team. Yeah, sorry about that. The logic, your logic, doesn't really track here. The Lakers have not won more than 35 games in 5 years, but you're pissed that a good player wants to come to your team. You're pissed that the best player on the planet wants to come to your team. I mean, what? Hey, don't come here, LeBron. We'd rather suck on our own. Thank you very much. Hey, LeBron, you know what you can do with your 28-9-9? Take them someplace else. Like, if we were going to get someone from the Cavs, we'd prefer that it was Jordan Clarkson. This dude's way more our style, way more our speed. You see, now is the time where I need to have a word with a certain section of fans. These, I want to be clear about this. These are not Laker fans. These are not Laker fans. Because there's a group of fans who now needs to decide if they're Kobe fans or if they're Laker fans. You know, it's sort of like that conversation we had back in the day with the Packers, where I brought this up every single day on the program. Are you a Brett Favre fan or are you a Packer fan? Woo! Well, that was tough on a Monday. Almost went Bodie with it. Listen, are you a Laker fan or are you a Kobe fan? Because if you're defacing a mural of LeBron in Lakers gear, you're not a Laker fan, you're a loser. Your team brings in arguably the best player of all time, and your response is, "No, King, we don't want you." I mean, so what's your deal? What's your problem? I mean, you do realize you don't have to choose between Kobe and LeBron, right? You do realize that Kobe himself endorsed the move and welcomed LeBron to LA. You saw that tweet, right? The tweet which read, quote, "Welcome to the family, at King James. Hashtag Lakers for life. Hashtag strive for greatness. At Genie Bus. At Magic Johnson. And RP, well done." End quote. See, that's the thing, right? You can like both these guys. I mean, nobody respects the Mamba more than yours truly. So I get your obsession with Kobe. The guy did win 5 rings. But embracing LeBron does not mean that you're betraying Kobe or disrespecting Kobe. It means you're about the team, not the guy. It's okay to like other players, just like it's okay to like James Worthy and Robert Horry, or Kurt Rambis and Eldon Campbell, or just Andrew Bynum, who's the best ever. There's your GOAT, by the way. You want to talk about a GOAT? Bynum. Bynum. Yeah, I'm pretty sure there's a bank in every town. Hey, listen, you don't have to choose between players. But if you're here to hate LeBron because he's not Kobe. Like, if you're here, people are going to hate LeBron no matter what. But if you're a Laker fan who hates LeBron because he's not Kobe, you're coming at it from a place of stupidity. Because no matter what LeBron does with the Lakers, it's not going to take away what Kobe did with the Lakers. LeBron is a Laker now. You need to get over that, get used to it, or just enjoy it. I mean, those are your options. Because I doubt that he's going to see, and understand this, this is really important. I doubt he's going to see that some dope wrote LaFraud on a mural and say, nah, have I signed anything yet? Nah, I'm going to bounce. I'm going back to Cleveland. They don't want me here. You see what they did to that mural? Now, see, that's not how that's going to go. He's going to see that, and he's going to think you're an idiot, and he'd be right. You're taking the arrival, and again, I'm talking to an alleged Laker fan or fans. You're taking this arrival of LeBron worse than Cleveland took the departure of LeBron. In some ways, you're taking this arrival of LeBron worse than Cleveland took the first departure of LeBron when he stabbed him in the back on TV. I mean, I can't wait for you degenerates to buy LeBron James Laker jerseys just so you can burn them in the street. I mean, that would show the world how much you don't want a good player on your team. Again, your hero, Kobe, has welcomed and embraced the dude. Time to do the same. Because to not do so is not only embarrassing to you, but to the rest of us in this town as well. 1-800-636-8686. I don't know. Like, I don't remember that when Shaq signed, Kareem fans taking to the streets with, oh, hell no. Or I don't remember when Kareem came here, Wilt Chamberlain fans taking to the streets and burning jerseys and defacing murals. When Wilt got here, I don't remember George Mikan fans taking to the street and burning things. When Mikan got here, or to Minneapolis, I don't remember Dr. James Naismith fans burning things in the streets. Come on now. How is this a bad thing? You've got the best player in the world. Granted, he's got some wear and tear. He's got some mileage, but he's still the best player in the world. Come on, Laker fans. Are you a Laker fan or are you a Kobe fan? And again, you're not going to find a bigger Kobe guy than me. You'll never find a bigger Kobe guy than me, but you're not disrespecting Kobe if you embrace LeBron. My man George Mikan would not be having any of that. 1-800-636-8686. I mean, come on. I grew up in Los Angeles. As a kid, I was a huge Laker fan. My first ever sports idol, my favorite athlete ever, my first ever athlete that I looked up to, that I sent a letter to asking for an autographed picture from, was none other than famous Laker Gail Goodrich. That's how old I am. But I didn't take it badly when they brought in other guards. I didn't burn anything when they brought in other guards. Nick Nurse, he joins us right now. Nick, good morning. It's great to have you on. How are you?
I'm good. Jim, how are you today?
Nick, I'm doing great. It's great to visit with you. Let me first ask you about your team in Vegas for the Summer League. If I start right there, what do you make, Nick, of what you've seen from your guys, and what kind of conclusions or information can you ultimately take away from Summer League play?
Well, we got a couple things going on, Jim. I mean, we got one of our rotation guys, OG Anunoby, who's a starter for us, and you know, we're just trying to give him a lot of touches and expand his game a little bit offensively. He was pretty much a spot-up three-point shooter. You know, he kind of hangs out and waits for DeRozan and Lowry and those guys to kick out to him, and he did a really good job. He's kind of a defensive specialist, but just trying to expand his game a little bit off the bounce, in the low post a little bit, and just decision-making. So that's one of our primary things. And then we got two or three other guys that are kind of on the fringes, one contract player and two guys that have been with us as two-way players and in our G League team. Those three guys are again fighting for, you know, a little bit more playing time, or fighting to make the team, or fighting to get to training camp. So kind of focused on those four players, really.
Nick Nurse, my guest. Boy, Nick, sounds like you settled right in. You know, it's been a little less than a month since you were named the head coach of the Raptors. I've got to ask, what were your first few weeks in charge like?
Well, it was pretty wild, Jim. You know, to be honest, you can't really explain it, like, just the amount of people that are contacting you. You know, a lot of them wishing you well. It's really nice. And then there's a whole fleet of people, you know, obviously trying to get on the staff or recommend people for the staff, et cetera. And obviously a lot of media to do at the beginning. It's just a pretty big whirlwind, but man, it's fun. You know, it's obviously different this time of year as an assistant. You're kind of chilling, hanging out a little bit. And when you're the head coach or a new head coach, you got a lot on your plate. And you got a lot of people to talk to.
The Monday edition of the Daily Jungle is brought to you by Fan Exchange. The dog days of summer are here. The stage belongs to baseball and clones. There is nothing better than a summer night at the yard. Tickets purchased on Fan Exchange are always guaranteed. No getting to the gate and worrying about getting in. Fan Exchange gets you closer to the action. Find the very best seats at the very best prices at fanexchange.com. Use the promo code Rome. That's promo code Rome. And get 50% off the service fees on your next purchase. Fan Exchange. We have tickets. Fan Exchange. Promo code Rome. Nick, we always talk about that. It might be one seat over, but that one seat, just moving that one seat over, might as well be a million miles. I mean, you mentioned being an assistant. Even though you were an assistant with the Raptors for 5 years, and Masai Ujiri, you two go way, way back, he didn't immediately name you the head coach after the team parted ways with Dwayne Casey. So I'm curious, what was the interview process like, and was there any part of you thinking, guys, I mean, you've known me for 5 years. What else do you need to know?
First of all, Jim, you know, I kind of thought I was going to have a really good chance to be a head coach this year. I was talking to some other teams and had interviewed with a couple teams and was maybe planning an interview with a couple more until things shook out in Toronto the way they did. I just didn't expect it to be in Toronto, to be honest. And when it happened, you know, they said, hey, we want to talk to you. And you know, they kind of interviewed me early on and first, you know, so then they had a process of getting through some other people. And it did take a long time. And I was getting a lot of calls and texts about, oh, it must be so frustrating for you to be waiting. And it didn't really bother me that much, Jim. It kind of made me feel like I was back in the G League or the D League. You know, people kept saying, well, you know, how come you can't get a call up to the NBA? And I was like, I don't know, but I'm having fun doing what I'm doing. I'm sure learning a lot and the chips will fall where they may. So I wasn't really that bothered by it. And the time passed and here we are.
Toronto Raptors head coach Nick Nurse is my guest. So I mentioned you and Masai go back a long, long way. In fact, Nick, all the way back to the mid 90s and the British Basketball League, you were an assistant for the Birmingham Bullets while Masai was playing for the Storm. What were those days in England like, and what do you remember about Masai as a player?
They were good days, fun days. First of all, they were, you know, I was kind of cutting my teeth there as a coach. I was 26, 27 years old, just trying to figure it out if I was any good at it and get some head coaching experience. And Masai played, funnily enough, I played for that same team, about 5 or 6 years earlier. I played for the Derby Storm and so he played for them, and he was a hard playing athletic defender. How about that?
Right.
For a scouting report.
Right. See, I mean, he definitely was that. I could see that. But when you're coaching in Europe, was there any feeling, and I get, Nick, that you were kind of cutting your teeth and you enjoyed it, but was there any sense that, man, I'm a long, long way away from the NBA. I might not get a shot to come back and coach the highest level. What was your mindset at that time when you were that far away?
Yeah, I think, you know, even the success you're having, and I kind of kept moving up, and I got some pretty cool jobs. You know, I coached a Euro League team. I coached a ULEB Cup team. I was involved in the British Olympic team as an assistant in 2012. And I was, you know, I was doing some neat stuff, but you're right. It was hard. It was far away. I was for a lot of years trying to re-enter back to the U.S. In some fashion. And as the D League kind of at that time was called, the D League was picking up some momentum. I thought that'd be a great re-entry point. You know, I've been coaching pro ball for, you know, 10, 12, 13 years. And you know, it'd be a good route if I could go get something done there. And it wasn't easy. I kind of had to go back to my home state of Iowa and get a group of guys together and start a team and tell them, let me be the coach for a few years to kind of re-enter the States. And that's just what we did. You know, we ended up doing good there. Won a championship at Iowa, and then the Rockets hired me and went to Rio Grande and then the Raptors. So, you know, it's been about 10, 12 years now back in the U.S., but it's led to this point, which which I guess all roads lead to here, you know.
Raptors head coach Nick Nurse joining us, and that's not even everything. I mean, then you had the head coaching stop at Grandview as well. In fact, what was life like at Grandview?
Well, that's again where I'm from a little bit. I was fresh out of college. It was a small little university there in Des Moines, and I had no idea what I was doing. I think I was 23 years old at the time. It's a long time ago, 27, 28 years ago. It was fun, you know. I mean, for me, I was getting to coach and be around ball and turn a program around and do what I love doing. So, you know, all the weird little stops I made along the way, people say, oh, man, you know, you're driving vans and you're doing this. It was fun. It was fun, man. We were getting in the van and driving to go play a game and driving home. You know, it was a good time.
You know, I wonder, Nick, I mean, it's great that it was fun, but, I mean, do you think that you'd be the kind of coach you are right now had you not traveled that path? I mean, if there were a quicker route to get here, would you be here and would you be the coach you are?
Well, I thought, you know, I wanted to get in the head coaching seat as quick as I could because I thought I wanted to see if I could do it and wanted to learn faster. And you already mentioned it's like a million miles from an assistant to being a head coach and the experience, the decision making, the chemistry building, the player rotations, you know, the X's and O's, game plans, all that stuff just changes exponentially, right? So I kind of a head coach mentality anyway, you know. So I probably got a 1,000 games under my belt officially as a head coach and probably another 1,000 at every little camp and summer league and free agent camp around the world that I could get my hands on. But I was doing that on purpose to continue to kind of build my craft and get better every year.
All right, so you're not only a head coach now, of course, you're an NBA head coach, and you've got a team that's got elite talent in DeMar DeRozan, Kyle Lowry. So when you're working with players like that, some of the best in the world, do you approach it the same way you would then, I don't know, like when you're at Grandview or the British Basketball League, or obviously it's a totally different animal and you got to change up?
Well, I think there's a lot of similarities, you know, that you can say basketball is basketball, like, you know, there's different rules and different whatever, but obviously the way you know, you motivate players or coach them or put them in situations where they can be successful, you know, it's different at this level. Like you know, like Kyle Lowry, for example, this guy's a super super smart IQ basketball guy. Like he really knows how to play the game. So I'm gonna, you know, give him the ball a little bit, put it in his stomach and tell him to run the team and let's work together on this thing. And maybe that's different from when I'm coaching a kid just out of high school who's still learning how to play. You know, obviously there's differences there.
What about DeMar DeRozan? When you look at him right now and yeah, where his head is at, where his game is at, what are you seeing? What's your message for him?
Well, I love DeMar. You know, DeMar's been a complete joy to coach. He's a great person. And obviously he's you know, second team all NBA. He gets buckets, man. The dude can score and is a great player. But we, you know, we've sat down and talked. He was one of the, you know, I went to see Lowry first and him second. And there's some things that we'd like to do differently. And you know, we're going to expand his game a little bit, continue to work that 3-point line a little bit more, continue to work setting up his teammates a little bit more, but also letting him do his thing. I mean, he's a bucket maker. And then the biggest challenge for me is we're gonna challenge him on the defensive end. Like, to me, if we can make DeMar more of a two-way player, then we got something.
So, Nick, when you sit with those guys, obviously you're going to say to them, hey, these are my thoughts. I appreciate you guys. Here's what I appreciate about you. And we're going to do a few things differently. Is it a two-way conversation? I mean, are they asking you questions? They want to know from you what your plan is going to be. What's that conversation like with your two best players?
Well, I'll give it to you just like it was with DeMar. I mean, he lives in L.A. in the summer. Obviously, he's from there, and I flew to L.A. and sat down with him, and he kind of got up on the edge of the seat, and he says, what do you got for me, coach? You know, what are we going to do? And, you know, so he started the conversation, and I kind of said, listen, I got three things for you, and I started in on him, and he was kind of taking the words out of my mouth as I was saying them. So, you know, it's not like there's, you know, any big secrets on some things guys want to improve on. And obviously I've been around them, spent a lot of time with 5 years, but yeah, there's a lot of communication and shared vision and shared goal setting and shared plan that you're going to go through with these guys. And these two guys are on board and are great. I'm really excited to watch it play out.
So, Nick, a final thought is you look at that team right now and you look at the rest of the Eastern Conference, what's it going to take to get this team to the finals?
Well, I think, Jim, one of the things that, you know, truthfully our knock is we've played really well in the regular season and not so well in the playoffs. So the things that we have to figure out to maybe peak a little bit more later in the year are things we're going to start putting in place from day one. You know, that's going to be our objective, whether it's mentally, physically, or tactically. We've got to have a long-term goal of trying to peak more at the end of the year and be playoff ready and playoff tougher and handle the reality of it. That is our reality. Nobody's going to care if we win 60 games or 52 games or whatever next year. They're going to wait till the playoffs come and see how we perform. And we've got to acknowledge that first and foremost. Get a plan and then execute the plan.
All right. So Saturday night in Las Vegas, there was a reckoning. And that reckoning was between Daniel Cormier and everybody who ever doubted him. I touched on this last segment. You know, all the people who were saying that he was a fake champion, a paper champ, somebody who somehow got lucky. Well, that argument, lame as it was, and it was lame, was demolished at 4:33 of the first round when DC's fist met Stipe Miocic's face.
Ladies and gentlemen, referee Mark Goddard has called a stop to this contest at 4 minutes, 33 seconds of the very first round. Declaring the winner by knockout and new undisputed UFC heavyweight champion of the world,
Credit UFC pay-per-view. That's Daniel Cormier, the so-called fake champ, knocking out arguably the greatest heavyweight champ in UFC history. From the so-called fake champ to the double champ in less than one round. That was the punch that took him from one of the best to the best. And that was a nice punch, a sweet punch. There was nothing lucky about that punch. Steps up in weight class, giving up who knows how much in height and reach, and beats the guy that nobody could beat. That's a monster performance, showing up in the biggest way possible, on the biggest stage, to become the baddest man on the planet. And if you were surprised, you should not have been. If you were surprised, you were one of those people who've been missing out on DC all along. If you're surprised, you're simply here to hate. Because Cormier is not only one of the best guys of all time, he is one of the best fighters of all time. How can there still be a single DC hater on the planet? It's beyond me, let alone crowds of them. And there are. Now, I would tell you to put some respect on this guy. I would tell you to show some damn respect for this guy, but I know I'm wasting my time. Not because he doesn't deserve it, he absolutely does, but if you did not respect him before, after everything he's done, and the consummate pro that he's been throughout the years, then you're never going to respect this guy. And that's more about you than it is about him. Cormier is a legend, and you're missing out completely if you're coming at it like that. I mean, for example, this guy could have been a heavyweight the entire time, but he and his friend Cain Velasquez did not want to be in the same division. So DC goes down to light heavyweight, where it's never been easy to make weight, and he still goes down as one of the greatest light heavyweights ever. And if you still want to bring this back to John Jones, that's fine, because Cormier knows that too. Quote, "Listen, for the people who called me a fake champion and said, you're not a real champion, you can't question this one. Maybe they could question my light heavyweight title to a certain degree. But I have something completely separate from him, and I'm so thankful. Everything was tied to him. No matter how much I beat everybody else, there was always that, oh, you lost to Jones. But now I'm in a division that I never got to complete my division in, and now I'm one of the greatest of all time. I love DJ, I love GSP, and it's going to be one of the three of us who is the greatest ever." End quote. I mean, hell yes, that is all truth. You might want to say John Jones is better. But availability is the best ability, and Jones is never available because he's too busy with hitting cars and failing drug tests to get into the cage and stay in the cage. DC, on the other hand, was not in any hurry to leave the cage. Not Saturday night, not without calling out the biggest man in the room.
The most amazing thing I've ever experienced. Now, Joe, let me get this microphone for a second. Hey, listen to DC. Listen to DC. There's a guy that I've known for a long time. He's a wrestler. He's an All-American. He's a former UFC champion. I never thought I would fight him, but Brock Lesnar, get your ass in here.
All right, so I know a lot of you didn't like that. A lot of you did not like that. To me, that's a hell of a moment. Because I'm thinking about the guy. Like, if you're trying to argue that it was staged or manufactured or contrived or that it cheapened the moment for DC, keep moving. Just keep moving. The guy just beat the greatest heavyweight of all time, stepped up in class, weight class to do it. He can say or do whatever the hell he wants. And if he wants to fight Brock Lesnar, then all the more power to him. And if you think that one shout-out did not just sell a million pay-per-views, you're wrong there too, because it did. And honestly, I don't really care. I don't really care what happens in that fight with Lesnar. DC was giving up a lot in size and reach to Stipe, and it looks like he's going to give up about 30 feet and a million pounds to Brock. See, when Brock pushed him, again, maybe it was manufactured, maybe it was contrived. But by comparison, DC, he looked like he was half his size. Lesnar looks like he's 12 foot 10. 12'10", 940. DC doesn't care. Because DC will do what DC does. Go to work, show up, give it everything he has. Is it a cash grab? Of course. Who cares? That doesn't matter to me either. Because DC has earned that too. By his own timeline, he has maybe two more fights left. And if he can cash in on them, more power to him because he has earned it. Because the nicest dude on the planet is now officially the baddest dude on the planet. We talked about it before the fight. He came on the show late last week, and I said, have you allowed yourself to imagine what it would feel like to get that second strap, to be the baddest man on the planet? Being the heavyweight champ comes with the other title of the baddest man on the planet. How much would it mean to you to prove that you've earned that title as well?
I'm a big boxing guy, watching my whole life. And before, when I was growing up, Mike Tyson, Evander Holyfield, Lennox Lewis, the heavyweight boxing champ was regarded as the baddest man on the planet. Can't say that anymore. The heavyweight champ is not the baddest man on the planet. The baddest man on the planet is the UFC heavyweight champion, because in a free fight, that mixed martial artist is going to win that fight. That title means so much because as a kid, I looked up to Tyson and Holyfield, those guys, and thought, man, this is the baddest man walking the face of God's earth, and I could call myself that on Sunday morning.
And he can on Monday morning and tomorrow morning. He not only won that fight, it's how he won that fight. By knocking arguably the best heavyweight in UFC history the hell out and doing so in the first round. So not only did he win that fight, it's how he won that fight. And what can you say about him now? Yeah, but he didn't beat Jon Jones. Yeah, but he knocked Stipe the hell out. Put him to sleep. What can you say about this guy now? And I didn't think he had anything to prove anyway. But on the biggest stage, in the biggest moment, this guy shows up and he shows out. DeAndre Ayton is my guest. DeAndre, great to have you on. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, man. I'm great. You're a couple of games into your summer league. So let me start right there. What has that experience been like for you so far?
I mean, it's a lot of energy. Really excited. A lot of excitement. Just a lot of – first game was a lot of butterflies, but, you know, I overcome that in the second game. I really played my game. And, you know, I really was comfortable on the court just talking to my teammates and having that chemistry already in a matter of just 4 days of practicing. I just really feel good out there, and it's really fun.
DeAndre Ayton joining us. All right, so you mentioned your teammates. After you went 21-12 on Saturday, your teammate Josh Jackson said, quote, I think he's finally starting to realize that nobody can guard him. Teams have to bring two defenders. No one person can guard him, just always being dominant, end quote. Does it feel that way to you, that at this point, nobody can guard you with only one guy?
Most definitely. Just really knowing my spacing on the floor now, and you know, first couple of games, I didn't know teams were going to double me in the NBA, but, you know, coming from college, been double and triple teamed, I know how to look around and know my spacing around the court and know where my teammates are as well. And now, I guess, you know, guys thinking that they can stand against me playing a one-on-one is just a better chance for me to either get to the line or get a good basket.
DeAndre Ayton joining us. You know, it's amazing to me that already, and you found this out, like you said yourself, well, I guess they're going to double me here in the NBA too. I mean, that's really significant, but what's it mean to you that only two games in, you've already earned that level of confidence and respect from a guy like Josh Jackson?
I mean, it's big time. You know, Josh is a great player. He's a very smart player as well. He just always been talking to me about how the NBA works and how, you know, the tricks and trades of the game and how it is during the game and what coach wants from me. And what the team needs from me on the defensive end as well. And, you know, just coming from me, I always played against Josh in high school. And, you know, we always go at it. But now being on his team, I really know why his team always wins. He's a winner. He's very smart. He's a leader to me as well.
DeAndre, take me back to draft night for a minute. I mean, the expectation for a while before the draft was you were going to go number one. But what was it like when you actually heard your name called and then it was official that you were the first pick in the NBA draft?
You know, I've been talking about it. I've been trying to speak it into existence. But, man, when Mr. Silver came out and announced my name, it was a dream come true. And just having that, just being in that moment and just hearing my name first called was just amazing. Just looking at the priceless faces and reactions my parents made was unbelievable. I never seen my mom and dad so excited, especially having Coach Miller there as well. It was just a blessing. And it was going to come true, just working hard every day. And you will be rewarded.
DeAndre Ayton, Sun Center, joining us. You mentioned your parents, so it makes me think about that journey. I mean, your journey to this point is amazing. We really wouldn't even have time to get into everything you've been through. But as you pointed out, you were traveling the basketball circuit. There were times when you really didn't even get the chance to speak to your mom for long periods of time. So when you look back at the journey and the work that you just mentioned, and you look at that journey itself, what kind of thoughts do you have?
The only thoughts I can possibly have is like, man, look where I came from. Like, I'll always try to keep myself level and grounded, just never forget where I came from, the type of work I've put in. And the only reason why I'm here is because of the work that I put in, and I got to keep doing it to be more successful.
DeAndre, what about the Suns? Now, the Suns have been through kind of a tough stretch for a while now, but there's a lot of positive buzz around that team. You're a big part of that. Now you're part of a young core that includes you, Devin Booker, Josh Jackson, name a few. How much are you looking forward to growing with this group, and then how good do you think this group can be?
I think going with this group can be amazing. We can become something good. We can really make history in Phoenix and really win a lot of games, especially as a young group. These guys, we're very young and hungry. We all have the work ethic. I've seen it in practice. I've seen sometimes in the weight room guys putting extra work in, guys staying after practice putting work in. We're just young. We have young legs. We can run all day. And I just, you know, some of these guys have been in the league for, you know, a couple, 2 years and 3 years, and they know the ropes in a matter of years, and I just know for a fact that it's going to spread and be more contagious with the work ethic.
DeAndre Ayton's my guest. You know, you've got the attention of a lot of guys around the league already. In fact, as an example, you and my guy C.J. McCollum sat down before the draft for a conversation on the Players Tribune, and one of the things that he said was that he missed a couple of naps this season so he could watch you play, and then after watching you, we thought that you could have played in the NBA last season.
What?
Knowing how much guys love naps, what did it mean to you to hear that he was giving up sleep to watch you play and to hear him say that he thought that you could play in the NBA even last season?
Man, that's big. You know, it shows that I'm doing the right thing and doing the right things on the floor. And it's really great people like him are recognizing it. And, you know, just hearing that compliment is just makes you want to work even harder and just keep on striving.
Listen, before I let you go, let me ask you a couple of things about this. Now, you're a guy with a big game and a big personality, and you know how people are, right? If you're cracking jokes or being yourself, then you must not be taking the game seriously enough. What's your reaction to that, and then how do you go about balancing the intensity it takes to be a great player, but also being who you are?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a young kid. I'm a kid, to be honest. I'm only 19 years old, so, I mean, there's a time and a place for everything my mom always used to tell me. And, you know, when it's time for business, it's time for business. You know, my coach always used to tell me, Coach Miller, when you're in between the lines, it's all business. when you come off the court, then it's time to really love one another, be yourself, and that's about it. It's like getting in a fight with your teammate on the court, but once you're off the court, that stuff don't matter anymore.
Speaking of that personality, now you've got a few sides to you, right? Like Josh, yeah. Like Eric, yeah. Like Alejandro, different characters and personalities that come out at different times. I'm not going to ask you to break down every one of these guys just yet, but the story goes, it came from watching Spider-Man and a scene with the Green Goblin. What do you remember about that scene, and what kind of an impact did it have on you?
I mean, just how he got Spider-Man's attention, saying, you know, he was saying it wasn't him that, you know, killed all those people in the movie. And, you know, it kind of got Spider-Man's attention, and he almost believed him until, you know, that little weapon thing that the Green Goblin tried to kill Spider-Man with. But I just think it's so cool to, you know, just changing your personality and changing your whole, you know, will just change people's minds from who they think you are.
I like it. I like it a lot. Last thought, you played a couple of years at Hillcrest Prep. You played at Arizona. Now you're the first pick in the draft for the Suns. I'd make the argument that you're one of the biggest celebrities in the Valley, but the other day you were working out and Diana Taurasi came over and you were, quote, freaking out. What did she say to you, and what was meeting her like?
Man, I mean, I was just working out. And I spotted her when she came in. Oh, I was looking through the mirror, you know, when I was looking at my guns. No, I'm playing. But, yeah.
Right.
She just walked over, and I'm like, I'm in my head, I'm looking at her, I'm like, yo, she's really about to walk over here. So I'm just like, you know, trying to lift the weight still. And she just came over, and I just popped right up, smiling and teasing and stuff like that. And she just was like telling me, you know, how much of a good job I'm doing. And she wanted me to keep it up. She's glad that, you know, I'm here. And, you know, she's like, we're family and stuff like that now. And just keep up the good work. And just those few words, just, you know, it's just big for me. I was speechless, to be honest. I can't even recognize I can't even think of my reaction. I was just really in shock.
All right, so the countdown to Smack Off 24 continues. Now we're just 11 days out, 11 short days until the television debut of the main event. In the lead up to the Smack Off, I've been profiling some of the key players. It's either a reminder to you, if you're a longtime listener, who these guys are, what they're capable of, or maybe it's your first time exposure to some of the voices that you're likely to hear 11 days from right now. So far, we've covered Mark in Hollywood and Iafredi, both champs, both dudes who know what it takes. We know Mark in Hollywood will be there because he has RSVP'd already. Iafredi, as always, is a game time decision. So we'll see. Today, I want to talk about somebody else. I want to talk about a guy that goes way, way, way back with the program. A guy who literally worked on the program. Another legend of the game. 14 guys have won this event, but nobody has shown up more than Steve Carbone. Now, last week I mentioned that Iafredi has been in 17 smack-offs. Carbone has been in 18. To my knowledge, that is the most ever. And it's his record as long as he keeps showing up. And if you're wondering, does this dude have anything to show for those 18 appearances? Hell yes. 16 top 10s, 5 podium finishes, 3 runner-ups, and a championship. A title that he ripped exactly 20 years ago, way back in 1998.
I'm going to give props where props are due. Props to Eddie the Dope for officially becoming the biggest freaking loser in the history of talk radio. Oh, by the way, Dope, I love your talk show. I still can't figure out why I never lasted. I mean, the same rehearsed takes on this show, the same callers from this show, a bad host, and no listening audience. Hell, you should have been on at drive time because of that. A fresh time slot. 3 o'clock in the morning on Sundays. Yeah, everyone's listening then. You know, and I'm not even going to bother to talk about the cyber slaps. Well, yes, I am. You know, brain devs, you know, I went to the Smack Chat board to see if there's any fodder for my call today, and I saw that Smack Chat was down yesterday. What's that like for you people? How do you manage a day without Smack Chat? Is that like not being able to one for a month? But hey, you gotta respect guys who can sit in front of their computers sending one sentence instant messages to their buddies 24 hours a day. I don't do any of this crap. I got a job and you don't. I get chicks and you don't. I get benefits and you don't. Basically, I got game and you don't. For the last time, losers, I'm not a clone. Out!
Carbone, full of vitriol in 98. I get chicks and you don't. I get benefits and you don't. I got a job and you don't. And him coming for, quote, Eddie the Dope. How about Smack Chat? Smack Chat. Man, this dude was angry. Really angry and really awesome. And it cemented his lifetime place in the Champions Club. All right, so that was the title. He won that title 20 years ago. Fast forward 13 years. Back in March of 2011, remember when Becky Black, I can't believe that was 2011, Becky Black dropped this toxic weekend anthem. You remember that was like the biggest thing in the world for like 5 hours? That ear poison was good for anything. And if it was, it was for a parody from Steve Carbone during Smack Off 17.
Trapper in the first hour, Oren in the second hour. Gotta make my mind up, which call sucked the worst.
I mean, Parody Larry wishes he could do that just once in his life. But that showed Carbone's knack for the topical. And that's not all. Like when he went on Periscope with his call back in 2015.
What I decided to do is something that hasn't been done in 21 years of the Smack Off, Jim. This is a first. Hi, everybody out there on Periscope. I'm waving to you right now, a live phone call. I don't need scripts. I don't need tag team partners to make my phone calls. Just me chilling in the office, talking to Jim, running my Smack. And that is a game changer, son. And you know why that's a game changer? Because I'm in the news, sweetheart. I have a degree. You don't. I wouldn't work in scumbag places like you do. Oh, my gosh. No education and no skill sets. Just to clarify that, I have a brain and you don't. I'm on TV and you're in effing trailers. Lose some weight, baby girls. Ball game.
Stevie Carbone, periscoping back in 2015. So now last year he was nowhere to be found. And it was only the fourth time in Smack Off history that he was not there. Because, and nothing's changed, he does have a job. He does have benefits. And he's busy. So we couldn't run him down last year. I'm hoping we run him down this year. And if you think Jeff in Richmond, coming from the grave to take a run at his first title in 16 years, imagine Stevie Carbone ripping one 20 years after his first. It could happen. He's got that lifetime exemption. He can use it anytime he wants. Will he use it in 11 days? And if he does use it in 11 days, given what this guy's done and the way he's changed the game a few times, I wonder what he'll come with if he does use it in 11 days.
Trapper in the first hour, Oren in the second hour. Gotta make my mind up. Which call sucks the worst?
So awesome to me to listen to these calls. And what was topical at that time and what made sense.
Punk asses wish they could join me on my Vegas trip. Friday, smoking pools on Friday. I'm gonna make love to all your girlfriends. These guys are all worthless. Yeah, hoping to be famous. Yeah, punk. Get alive, losers. Rise and fire.
Rise and fire, Stevie Carbone. We are joined by Bruce Feldman. Bruce, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. Good to be on with you.
Good to have you, Bruce. Lots to talk about. I want to start first with your annual Freaks List, which is coming out on The Athletic this week, because it's now an annual tradition and it gets its own week. Take me back a little bit, Bruce. How did this list first start?
You know, it was going back just where in the off season where you're looking for something to write, and you'd always hear from different schools, there was always some guy who had some amazing ability, either 44-inch vertical jump or some guy who looked like he was 50 pounds overweight, yet could be freakishly, could do backflips and do all this other stuff. And so I wanted to kind of find a way to spotlight some of these guys. A lot of them would be guys who would shine at the combine. Then there was other guys who would just their athleticism, or maybe their athletic background. I mean, I'll have a guy this week later in the week, who is from Germany, grew up a champion mogul skier. You know, some of the amazing things he can do. Well, Michigan just just signed him a few months ago. And it'll be interesting to see what kind of player he ends up developing into. But, you know, you see guys with just this uncanny athleticism, and you were, and I was really trying to find a way to kind of write about it, and that became the perfect venue for it.
Bruce Feldman joining us. And then on top of that, Bruce, what's interesting to me is, aside from the notion itself, but they're showing up in lots of really interesting places. As an example, you've already unveiled numbers 50 through 41 on the list, and some of these guys are playing in places like East Carolina, Ball State, Buffalo, Western Michigan. So what does that tell you about some of the smaller programs that they're getting special athletes like this? Is it a one-off or is it a trend?
No, I think it's something where guys know back, you know, back when we were growing up, Jim, there would be only, you know, a handful of teams would get to play on national TV. Now you can go anywhere and be seen. I mean, one of those guys that I wrote about today, you know, was a phenomenal volleyball player, had college scholarship offers for that in Division I. He vertical jumps 42 and a half inches. We have video of him doing that. He's a defensive back. He's kind of raw still as a player for Buffalo, but they have some really good, promising NFL talent there. And as, you know, NFL fans will know, they produced one of the best players in the NFL a few years ago, Khalil Mack, who was kind of a fall through the cracks recruit coming out of Florida. And he just blew up when he went to Buffalo. And there are guys like that all over the country. You know, later in the week, I'll have a couple of guys from Appalachian State who they could go play anywhere. And I think when you see some of these guys when they get to the combine, and certainly when they get to the NFL, you know, certain guys develop at different times. And then, like I said, there's just a lot of guys who end up still falling through the cracks for one reason or another and end up at these places where they just kind of really blossom.
Bruce Feldman joining us. And then, Bruce, you've got a guy that everybody knows in Saquon Barkley, who was the number one guy on your list last year. Then he goes on to have the year that he had. And the workout videos, Bruce, that he's been posting as he preps for his first NFL season are ridiculous. What is it about him that made him so special?
I think it was, you know, obviously he's genetically blessed, but I think the biggest thing with him was the work ethic that he has. And, you know, we did some stuff with him at Fox Sports last year. And I remember, you know, I spent some time with him last spring. And we had this conversation about, you know, usually guys who are that gifted, you always think they're the best athlete in their area. So we were talking about the hardest thing he had to go through. And he goes, you know, when I'm like in eighth or ninth grade, I really struggle with my confidence as an athlete. I said, weren't you like the – and he comes from a, you know, not a huge place in Pennsylvania. It's not like he comes from – you know, Miami, which is cranking out players, or Los Angeles. It's not like there's a ton of NFL players from, like, his area. There's some, but not a lot. And he goes, I wasn't the best player in, you know, on my team or even close. And the best player, it turned out, you know, who he said was, like, their Johnny Manziel at that point, was a kid who was just a regular student at Penn State. And what you had was, and this, when I, you know, talked to this kid for the story about Saquon, talked about going to the facility, their high school facility, one night in the summer and seeing Barkley pushing a truck up the hill near the stadium. This is back when he was, you know, whatever, 15, 16 years old, and that was the work ethic. And really, I mean, he has just seen what it's done for him, and that's what I think motivates him is, hey, I work this hard, I'm going to thrive. And it did wonders for his confidence, and obviously – he had an amazing career at Penn State, and I think he's going to have an amazing career with the Giants.
Bruce Feldman joining us for a few more moments. You know, when you talk about Penn State, Bruce, he and his classmates from Penn State blew everybody away at the NFL Combine, and the strength and conditioning has been a key part of the rebuilding that James Franklin has done at Penn State. I mean, he followed up a pair of 7-win seasons with back-to-back 11-win seasons. Bruce, it was not that long ago that Penn State appeared to be dead as a program, and now Franklin's pulling in amazing recruiting classes. How do you explain that, and how is he doing that?
Well, I think some of it is a track record. Now, as you mentioned, they went to a Rose Bowl. They also, as you said, you know, I did a story about this the other day for The Athletic where they have had a track record of guys coming through there. It wasn't just Barkley who lit up the combine. There was like four other guys who tested almost off the charts. But the story I did last week, I talked to some of the parents of some of these 4- and 5-star kids who are now going to Penn State, and they said it really all comes back to James Franklin. And they said his accessibility as a head coach, they said you go visit other schools and the head coach, you have to schedule time with them. Maybe you'll see them once or twice over the weekend. James Franklin is around all the time. And they said, you know, we know our kids probably could be good football players and do well at other places. But when it comes to developing and finishing the product, one of the parents had shot this video of Franklin giving a speech, and you saw James Franklin getting emotional on the speech he gave to these families about why it's personal and not just business to him to help raise their sons. And that message has really resonated with a lot of families, and that's why, you know, they're getting blue chip kids like they haven't in a really, really long time in state college.
Bruce Feldman, my guest. Bruce, you did an amazing piece, I thought, also on sign stealing that we will have to talk about another time, but it's really, really interesting. He's a reporter for Fox Sports and FS1, a writer for The Athletic, and a New York Times bestselling author. Bruce, great to have you back. Thanks so much for doing that.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jim.
Meantime, another week and another Phil Mickelson rules violation. Remember last time? It was hefty stick handling on the 13th green at Shinnecock and then playing that off like that was a tactic or a strategy. This time, though, it's him stomping down the fescue at the 7th tee at the Greenbrier so he could hit a low stinger. And just when you thought that Hefty had learned his lesson about playing fast and loose on the course, dude, yet again, mind melts and gets himself another 2-stroke penalty.
All right, the tee back there, Robert, to
sure
feel.
What I just did is legal.
I think so, yeah, okay. I'll ask somebody. But.
I'll see if I can do some investigative reporting.
All right, he walked up. Oh, he walked up and tapped that down.
Uh-oh!
I was on the tee box, and I was going to do it really well. Okay. And there was grass
sitting up front, right? Knock it down
before I hit.
Let me run it by the
85. Yeah, I didn't dawn on me, and then I was like,
I think
"Yeah, might be." Okay.
Had I
picked up my key, moved it to the side, where it didn't affect the shot, I would have been okay.
No problem.
Is it me, or is this guy looking to con somebody every second of every day? And just play it off with that charm, you know, that hefty charm. Well, I didn't know. Like, if you were watching on CBS Sports Network, you can actually see Phil go to the front of the tee and stomp down that hay. If you're listening, you can hear him stomp down that hay and then come back to the tee and say, quote, "I'm not sure what I just did is legal," end quote. Yeah, well, it turns out that it's not, Hefty. Turns out you should have asked that question before you went out to the hippie hair and stomped it with your cleats. And while it did not ultimately matter for a guy who teed off like 3.5 hours before the leaders and ended the tournament 18 strokes back of the winner, the big man is finding new and more absurd ways to trample his reputation. Now, most lefty lovers are taking this as a chance to commend him for turning himself in. They're supporting their guy because he sought out a rules official and technically called the penalty on himself. I mean, please. Trust me, dude is fully aware. Fully aware the cameras were on him. Fully aware that he was out of the tournament. Fully aware that he had no choice. Not after that circus stunt that he pulled at the U.S. Open. And let me get out in front of this one for you, H-Man. The foot wedge is not allowed at the Open Championship at Carnoustie either. The RNA has the same rules for cheating as the USGA in that you're not allowed to do it. You can't cheat. I mean, my man's been on tour since 1992. 92. That means he's been playing roughly 4 rounds of golf a week for nearly 3 decades. Would it be too much to ask that he actually learned the rules of the game? I mean, we all know this guy's been carrying around a little extra weight or a little extra around his waistline for the better part of his career. Here's one thing that he apparently has not been carrying: a rule book. My man, your pockets are there for a reason. Jam a rule book into them and not another peanut butter Sando. Come on, man. Dude, you're a Hall of Famer. You're a Hall of Famer. People love you. Stop making a mockery of the game and a fool of yourself every time you peg it up now. I mean, come on now. Like I said, is there ever a moment where he's not conning somebody? Him just, like, charming his way out of everything. Hey, yeah, you know, I probably shouldn't have done that, right? I'm not allowed to do that, am I? Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I wasn't even thinking about that. Yeah, okay. That's twice. That's two for him. Two that we know of.
It's two for me.
Hefty.
Don't bring that with you to the Open Championship. Can't cheat there. Can't cheat here. Can't cheat there. And cheating, like you know the old saying, I've said this for years, and this is not something I made up either. If you're not cheating, you're not trying, and it's only cheating if you get caught. This guy keeps getting caught. And the difference is, in golf, cheating is not to be admired. It's a gentleman's game. They take that stuff very seriously. In other things, it's like, yeah, people cheat. People cheat a lot. People cheat in every sport. Golf's a little bit different. It's a game of honor and integrity. Cheating, for instance, in baseball or football or basketball is not the same as cheating in golf. Those within that world do not look kindly on that. Jamie in Green Bay tweets, it's only a matter of time before Phil starts finding his ball in the fairway that we saw go into the woods. Let me give the guys in New York a chance to put up that picture of Rex wearing his Rolex. There it is. Rex, what's going on?
Hey, Jimmy. You know, in all fairness to Phil, that fescue rough was pretty tall. You know, in fact, I think it was taller than Vern Troyer. May he rest in peace. You know, poor Vern, there wasn't a lot of money left for a funeral, so he had to be buried in a Build-A-Bear box.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Barry in San Diego. Barry, good morning. How are you? What's up?
Hey, great to hear you and Sills in the morning. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, I just want to throw my hat in the ring and say, Jeff in Richmond, glad to hear about the big find. Your whole entire estate on short sale in the dumpster behind Toys R Us. Even Barbie didn't want it back. Now, to the Laker fans who are hating on LeBron, what? Do us both a favor. Take all that frustration, head on over to Carson, and visit the Spanises. They're great at working things out. Now, for Mona, the super nurse who battles cancer or beat cancer and abuse and bullets all while nursing in the ER, remember, whether you're in the hospital or in the jungle, every nurse has got to answer to the doctor. And that's me, Dr. B-Man SD. Bow down!
No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Hey, Doc, I don't want to point the finger at somebody else. I didn't run you like that. Alvin did, though. Alvin, because you self-glossed.
Levi the Trash Man.
It's Iceman.
Lonnie Carter in Spokane.
The Axe.
Bighorn from Windsor, Ontario.
They call me the bowling ball here in Tampa.
Jay Dizzle.
Manny Cheeseburger over here.
Go by the name of Shot Callers.
The Clone Prophet.
This is the Grump.
This is the Grouch.
Moldoggy in NorCal, East Bay to be exact.
The Dougler. I'm from the city of Fad Diets and Yoga Pants.
The Zookeeper.
Oh, good gloss. Where did that come from?
At a buddy's wedding.
So you gotta call me Roaster.
Actually, this is Garbage Man, Brad.
Not Jonathan, it's Jip.
My boys call me the Cracker Jack.
G-Money.
Actually, they call me Sexy Rexy from New Mexico.
They call me the Red Dog.
Let's go with Horse Monkey today.
On the court, they call me the Tree Frog.
This is G-Money, Rack Me James.
All right, Dave, see you, bud. Wait a minute, G-Money? He's went self-gloss.
Every nurse has got to answer to the doctor. And that's me, Dr. B-Man SD. Bow down.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Or am I going to rip it? If he does nothing, I rip it. If he comes in here and makes a solid call, he's probably going to be in good shape for the event. Let's find out. We go to New York right now. John. John, good morning. How are you?
Tim, I'm doing great. How was your weekend?
Good, man. Great.
Awesome. I just wanted to call and congratulate Laker fans on LeBron, Jim. That's good news for L.A., but bad news for gas station owners who will be spending more money on security trying to keep Matt from L.A. from setting up camp in front of the pumps to watch his new-look Lakers on gas station TV. Hey, Mike and Indy, rumor has it that some of those You Better Don't t-shirts showed up in rag boxes used on trucks. If they showed up in my shop, they would be put in the bathroom right next to the toilet paper, just in case people wanted to wipe their ass with them. You better should take a trip to San Antonio and ask Jeff to change your diaper, because that's the only thing that sissy should be good at by now. Afterwards, both of you can sit down and just cry at each other. We'll call it the first annual bitch off. Let me tell you something, Mike. The show makes you. You don't make the show, you long streamer Yuri. When I see you on the 20th, it'll be like Larry Holmes meeting Mike Tyson again. Jim, that's all I got. I'll see you on the 20th, too. Thanks, Jim. I'm out.
John in New York. So when he's talking about seeing Mike on the 20th, and I'll see you also on the 20th, Jim, I mean, is he commanding it as so? Is he willing it to be? We go to the phones. Matt. What's up, Matt? How are you?
Snaglio Van Snagger. Hey, thanks for the vine. From Irvine to Iran, from Costa Mesa to Colombia, from Lake Forest to Luxembourg. You're welcome. Thanks to Uncle Hawk and the New York City CBS Sports Net for treating the wide world of clonedom to an eye-gasmic dose of the Matt in L.A. montage. But, Pimp, I'm not calling to hype myself up. I know my legion of Twitter folks will do that for me. I'm calling because I caught wind that some greenhorn slap runner on the eastern seaboard is running his Long Island lapper lips. Hey, Johnny, come lately. Keep my name out your mouth. Just because LeBron and all NBA big names continue to shun Jimmy D's garage door, blues band, and the decrepit shack that used to be the mecca for hoops, MSG, is no reason to be jealous of Laker fans like myself. Pimping the jungle on gas station TV, printing up bootleg LeBron Laker gear as we do, you stock market shipping room flunky. Get your own damn hustle. Take your aging Enos Kanter or broken down Kristaps Porzingis gear online, because you ain't going to get no love on the streets of the Big Apple from the fake New York Knicks fan stockbrokers jumping on board the L.A. Laker bandwagon as we speak, you puke. Hey, John, Manhattan clam chowder sucks, and so do your calls. War aloha means a hola. Unwar jealous NBA fans, and unwar the Manitoba Mimbos and their whack-ass wrist slap. Outro.
Matt in L.A.
Good night now!